So would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. My name is Kevin. I am the singer for Of Montreal.
So is this like a mini British invasion, except it's coming from Georgia?
Yeah, we tend to pop up every once in a while. You know, there's like that scene with the REM and B-52s and apparently Matthew Sweet. And then, you know, there's the whole Elephant Six collective that happened like 10 years ago or whatever. And New Smoke Hotel and Olivia Tremor Control. And, you know, there's still some really good bands from that scene. Like, we are sort of like on the fringe of that scene. Elf Power still going strong. And there's some really good bands. Summer Hymns. And there's a band called the late BP Helium, which has members of Montreal in it and stuff. So, yeah, there's a lot of really great bands.
I need the latest version of how the band was formed. Like, the woman who wasn't actually from Montreal, but was from Outremont. That there are 64 different stories of how this all started. So you want to make a new one up, or you want to tell me one that's actually, that people can actually follow and believe?
Well, the name comes from NASCAR, originally. You know, I started off following Formula One, but then started getting more into NASCAR. And there was a driver named Dick Trickle. And I thought that was a really interesting name, you know, for a man and for a NASCAR driver. And so I was a fan of his. I was a member of his fan club and stuff. And it turns out that he was a sort of music enthusiast. And he was kind of into what I was doing at the time. And but I didn't have a band name at the time. And so, you know, we sort of going back and forth, pen pal, you know, sending letters back and forth. And this before the internet, really, before email was a super accessible thing. And so I just asked him, you know, like, what would you name your band if you could name your band something? And he said, you know, Canada is cool because it's so close to the United States, but, you know, it's sort of more progressive than the United States. And it seems like it'd be good to have some sort of affiliation with Canada. And I was like, okay, well, what do you think we should do? And he had just seen the movie Jesus of Montreal. And he was like, oh, okay, you know, maybe you should name it Of Montreal. And then I was like, okay, well, that'd be cool. And then I didn't really think about it, you know. It's kind of funny because then there was like this big boom within the last like 5 years. All these bands were coming out of Montreal, and all of a sudden,
Arcade Fire,
yeah,
right.
Broken Social Scene,
right.
Chromeo, I think is from there. All sorts of bands were popping out of there, and so then, you know, it kind of came like, oh, you're part of like the Montreal scene or something. It's like, yeah, we are, sort of.
Did you ever think that this, whatever you want to call it, a project, a band, a collective, a thing, would be where it is, you know, 10 years after you formed it?
We were struggling for a really long time, and we were struggling for like 5-6 years before, you know, really reached any sort of like fan base. You know, we had like, and we were only selling like a couple hundred copies of our records, you know, for a long time, and, you know, touring nonstop and still keeping up the same sort of tour schedule that we do now, but playing to like 20 people every night, you know, and totally living like hand to mouth and foot to mouth as well. You know, so that, yeah, it was, I always felt like what we were doing was good, you know, and I felt really good about it and felt proud of it or whatever, you know, but it wasn't commercial at all. And then we somehow started reaching people within the last like 5 years. And it's kind of weird because it's almost like all those years that we spent paying our dues didn't really exist, because there aren't that many people even know those older songs, you know, like everyone kind of came on ship with like, you know, I guess 4 records ago, Satanic Panic in the Attic and everything that came after that. So it's almost like those were like lost years, but in a way they were good for us because, you know, we were paying our dues and like, you know, getting kind of a lot of experience that would help us, you know. So now, like, it doesn't matter how successful we are, it's never going to go to our heads because we've been humiliated for so long, you know, before we became successful. And it's very traumatizing, you know, when you've been putting out records for years and performing in front of like 10, 15 people for years and years and years and years, you know. It's like when you struggle like that, then when you do have some success, you know, you can, it doesn't really go to your head because you're just like, oh, this is great. But you know all too well like what it's like to be down at the bottom, you know. So it's not like instant success, how that can kind of mess with people, you know. So now like we've developed like really good habits. I have personally like artistic habits about recording and writing, and I don't write for an audience, you know. I don't worry about that. I don't worry about selling records. I write because the creative process fulfills me in a way, and it's what I live for, you know. And so I'm smart enough to know that if I try to think about, if I try to change that and try to make music that will sell, then I'll deprive myself of that good thing, you know? So I stay away from that. I stay away from, you know, reading reviews or, you know, trying to imagine what people want or anything like that. Just do what I feel compelled to do.
There's a reasoning behind this whole Apollinaire Rave Collective. So why don't you tell me a little bit about, you know, it wasn't just that you wanted to be cool and put the record in different formats. You kind of had a mindset behind it, did you not?
It gave us an opportunity to produce all these art objects that we had wanted to for a long time. You know, just even for ourselves. Like, so, you know, we were looking online and trying to find, like, cool things that we can just decorate our own houses with, decorate our own living spaces with. And so we realized, like, with the industry going in the direction that it's going now, there's less attention put on physical objects and more attention put on, you know, non-physical objects, like download coupons, or I guess, you know, just downloading codes and things like that, you know? So, like, you can sell records, you know, in a way that you couldn't have sold them years ago. And, you know, that kind of gives you a new opportunity to do things like this, you know, where you're like, okay, well, the packaging sense, like the music is not going to be on a physical object. It's not going to be on a CD or vinyl, mini disc or whatever, you know, it's just going to be something that you just take from space, you know? So you still want a physical object to go with the record, or, you know, to go with the album. So you can create anything you want. You know, so you could, like, say, okay, like we did. So the Chinese lantern, you know, that's the packaging for the digital download. Or, you know, the wall decals is the packaging for the digital download. So, you know, basically just taking this thing that no one's really done before, you know, because normally people say, okay, a digital download, you don't expect to get anything with it. You don't expect to get anything physical with it. Maybe just, like, you know, a thumbnail image of the album cover that you can, like, put on your iPod or whatever. But, like, we thought it'd be really exciting and really fun, you know, to offer people all these other different alternatives to that. So you can still have a physical object that you connect with, you know, because for us, like, packaging is so important. And it's a real shame when you download a record and you don't get that, you know, you don't get the booklet or whatever it is. And you know, being such a fan of, like, 60s music and you know, being just a fan of music in general, the packaging has always been something very important to me, you know, and I have, like, a direct connection. Every record, when I listen to the record, I think of the album cover. You know, and I think of, like, the booklet that came with it. It's impossible to listen to Sgt. Pepper's, you know, without thinking of the album packaging. So, you know, we're trying to kind of bring that back, you know. So, you know, you can still download records and also have a connection to something physical, you know, some art that comes with it.
So the sequencing and the way that you put together this record is kind of in a grand tradition for me. And the ones that came to mind were, you know, Smile or something by Zappa or something like that. Now, for people who don't get it, let's tell them, you know, what you had in mind when you put together this record. Again, it was more artistic virtue than anything else, right?
Yeah, well, you know, those records that you named were definitely influences, you know, and that sort of, as a young man, I sort of realized the potential of pop music, you know, that it didn't have to just be, you know, 12 songs that started and finished in a linear fashion and everything, you know, would resolve in a predictable way, you know. And, you know, I listened to Smile for the first time. It completely blew my mind when I realized, like, you know, what you could do, that you there weren't any rules, really, you know. Any rule was just something that you just imagined, you know. And I think that a lot of, in music, for some reason, it's acceptable and almost encouraged for people to be sort of lazy and just to sort of follow the path, you know, that has already been created by these other successful artists. But for me, it's more, you know, I put out a lot of records, and I've done this in the past as well. Like, we have a record called Coquelicot, Sleep in the Poppies, that is sort of similar in structure to Skeletal Lamping, but it's, you know, just kind of a different musical style, kind of pulling from different influences at that point. But, you know, this is something that I've done before, and the whole, like, Elephant Six Collective, you know, a lot of those bands were really inspired by that as well, like the sort of totally free-form songwriting style where anything, a song can go in any number of directions, can contain any number of sections and movements, and, you know, you can still call it a song. You know, it doesn't, you won't have to break each section up and say, no, each section is its own song or whatever, you know. So it's just basically just having fun, you know, just being experimental and being creative and trying to create something that is unpredictable and dense, you know, so you can listen to it a number of times and hear something new every time.
Yeah, there's a couple of tunes. It's funny, I was listening to it in the car on the way here. You know, what I do is I find a few tracks that I want to play, and then I go back and I listen and I find more, and there's like two or three tracks that I can just see them being played at midnight in a club, and then people going, whoa, wait a minute, this is of Montreal, and yet it's ready to go, right?
Yeah, there's some songs that are definitely sort of dance floor ready. Other songs that would probably just confuse people because, you know, there's so many different tempo changes.
Like track number two, perhaps.
Yeah. That one, there's a lot that sort of start off like, okay, this is cool. And I mean, maybe some people, that I think that, like, you know, some criticism of the record has been that people have been a bit frustrated because they like a certain groove and then it just goes away and never comes back.
I don't think the White Album, you know, gave people something to hang on to, did it?
No, I mean that, I mean, yeah, there's, I'm a huge Os Mutantes fan. Mm-hmm. And the first two Os Mutantes records are just like the Bible for me, you know, like go back to them and listen to them constantly, and I never get sick of them. And I think the reason that is because, well, number one, I don't understand what they're saying, so there's a mystique there because I don't speak Portuguese, but musically, it's just always changing, it's always evolving and developing, and the movement of the music is completely unpredictable. And you know, when you have something like that is very, like, captivating and provocative, it stays with you for a long time, you know? And a lot of people kind of want their music to be sort of disposable, you know, and just like, oh, this is my jam for the week or whatever, and then you forget it a week later, you know? And I'm not making records like that. And I kind of hope that, you know, within the record there could be, you know, jams of the week or whatever, but also, you know, it is a record that you could listen to for your whole life. And the thing is, I love pop music. I love singles. I love dance music. And so what I wanted to do is make something that had the immediacy and the infectious quality of pop music and dance music, and that was still fun and, you know, didn't hurt your head too much, but then at the same time structured in a way that was very complex, you know, and just sort of, you know, sort of like pop music, taking pop music somewhere just different, you know? Like, I wanted to make a record that you couldn't really say any other record was really just like that, you know, this year. It'd be a record that stands on its own.
So I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs is the bread. And then you can pick anything you want. Give me a bunch of songs off the cuff for in between.